Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, the cover of Time magazine showed a young woman who was brutalized by her in-laws in Afghanistan. The photo revealed the horror of life some women there face, and it raised again questions about the U.S. remaining militarily engaged in Afghanistan. Joining me to talk about the security situation, the strength of the Taliban, and options for the U.S. military, here in the studio, Ambassador James Dobbins. He's former special envoy to Afghanistan, retired Colonel Douglas MacGregor, and David Wood with Politics Daily. Joining us from the NPR studios in New York City, Yael Lamont. She's reported on Afghanistan for the Daily Beast. She is now with the Council on Foreign Relations. And throughout the hour, I'll look forward once again to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. If you prefer, send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you. It's good to have you with us. And let me start with you, David Wood. You just returned from Kandahar. Tell us about what you saw there.
Diane, this was my fifth trip to Afghanistan, and for the first time, I saw the beginnings of local government, and I think this is the key to understanding what's going on and may happen in Afghanistan in the months and years ahead. I think in Washington, when we think of whether Afghanistan has a functioning government or not, we think of Kabul, but I think that's the wrong end of the prism to be looking at it. What I saw in Kandahar, and to a varying degree in other parts of the country, because I did make a pretty good tour of the country, was the beginnings of almost grassroots local government, district level, people participating, villagers participating in making decisions about how their lives are going to be run, primarily on two issues, development and security. But boy, it's a beginning. It was pretty interesting.
And for you, Ambassador Dobbins, how do you see the current situation in Kandahar, and why is that so important?
Well, I agree that that there is a beginning of the beginning of a bottom-up approach in terms of the American and allied and Afghan government efforts. That is to build not only top-down, a government that's capable of providing services to its population, but also to begin to build from the bottom up local leadership, a greater degree of autonomy and responsibility. It's difficult to do, but there are efforts both in the security area, that is empowering local villagers to be first responders in case of Taliban incursions, and provision of resources to local councils, allowing them to determine how the resources are used within their village or tribal area. And I think this is an important innovation in General Petraeus' strategy.
Gail Lamont, what about the status of women in Afghanistan, and how important is that to what's happening there?
Well, I think it's really important. I mean, you're talking about half the population, and half the population who, if it gets educated and is able to work, can help support the other half in a country that is desperately poor. I think with women, it's probably the same as with men, which is you have, you know, signs of real setbacks amid pockets of tremendous progress. In terms of the setbacks, I think you see increasingly large swaths of the country that are really difficult for women to move around in. Women who face night letters, who face difficulty getting to work, who face difficulty going to school because of an increasingly vibrant Taliban presence. On the flip side, women have made the really great strides in terms of using the spaces created by the international community. And when they've had even the smallest pocket, they've really made real opportunities for themselves, whether it be starting their own businesses, whether it be working as midwives, whether it be serving as teachers, whether it is, you know, helping their family in terms of farming and helping their families with market access with the number of development programs. Mm-hmm. And it also in terms of serving in Parliament. I was in an extraordinary news conference right before the Kabul conference in Kabul, where women, 200 women who had gathered, actually read the Riot Act to Staffan de Mistura, the head of the UN presence there, and the finance minister of Afghanistan, and the EU representative saying, "You didn't represent us. Why aren't we heard in the Kabul conference?" And it was really extraordinary because, having gone back and forth for 5 years to Afghanistan, I had never seen women really speak up for themselves like that.
And yet, Gail, tell us what you know about the woman who was on the cover of Time magazine last week, Bibi Aisha.
Absolutely. Well, I first reported on her last November. I met her last November and did a story on her for the Daily Beast last December and have been following her story since. She was given in Baad, what's a practice called Baad, which is when women are given to settle a dispute between families. So she was given to this man as a wife when she was barely adolescent. I think she was maybe 12 or 13 at the time. Had no choice in it. The family abused her, the mother-in-law abused her, the in-laws abused her. She escaped, landed in prison in Kandahar, which is actually not very unusual for women who are abused. And as penalty, once she was returned to her husband's family, she had her nose and ears cut off by a group of local Talibs with her in-laws holding her down.
I gather she is now in California, is that correct?
That is. And, you know, it was actually because of the U.S. military that she landed in California. And she's there now, had her first consultation for medical help, and will be getting medical help in the U.S.
And Colonel McGregor, July was clearly the deadliest month for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Do you expect it to get worse?
Well, I think it will be episodic. I think there'll be times when we'll see more Americans killed and times when we'll see fewer Americans killed. We're dealing with, truthfully, a very weak adversary. This is not a powerful force. He has no air defenses. There is no army. There's no air force to deal with. We have overwhelming power, if you will, on call. I don't think that's the issue. I think what's interesting about our conversation right now is that we're not talking about the strategic rationale for being there. We're not talking about why it does or does not make sense to be there. We're talking about nation building. This whole counterinsurgency business that began in Iraq has turned into a Trojan horse for nation building. We're spending perhaps $200, $250 million a day in this country. We're trying to establish institutions and a way of life that simply has no cultural foundation. And we're expecting to do this in a space of a few years on the assumption that somehow or another there will be an enduring outcome that will be beneficial to the people that live there or ourselves. And the other thing we're talking about is the plight of women. And quite frankly, if you want to reform the societies where women are suffering, you're going to have to start somewhere along the west coast of Africa and commit your resources from there to Southeast Asia. You're going to be very busy. I don't think that's something that we can really undertake. And again, you know, all of this depends upon your willingness to stay virtually in perpetuity and impose your will ruthlessly. And I don't see much evidence that we can afford it or that we're willing to do it.
And yet the plight of Bibi is being exploited by those who think we should stay in Afghanistan.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is something that people who advocate these nation building with military forces will do repeatedly to try and drag the American public into this. I don't think it's working, frankly. I think the American public has largely walked away from all of these interventions at this point. And again, I don't think we can afford it.
Ambassador Dobbins, can we afford it? How long do you see us there?
Well, I think the administration is on a glide path which intends to turn over all combat responsibilities to the Afghans by 2014 and begin to reduce the American presence from its current levels beginning next summer. The exact glide path between next summer and 2014 isn't known, and it'll depend on the success of the campaign, and in particular on the degree of competence that Afghan army and police forces show. And they have shown, particularly the army, some improvements in recent months.
Give me an example of the kind of improvements you're talking about.
Well, first of all, they're much larger. They've reached the target date of, I think, 280,000 total between the two forces several months early. The police are still hampered by allegations of corruption. That's less a problem with the army. The army is fighting. It's taking casualties. It's capable of some autonomous operations. And American commanders are always calling for more, not less, Afghan forces because they find them a very valuable supplement to their own efforts.
And how important do you believe the Taliban is in this whole issue of how long the U.S. stays there, how destructive the Taliban is? How do you regard them?
Well, the Taliban clearly are the main adversary. It's not an entirely unified insurgency. There are different strains within it, but it's unified enough so that it can be considered as a single adversary. And there are about 30,000 fighters, and they're tenacious, but not omnipotent, as the colonel suggested.
Ambassador James Dobbins, he's director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. And we're back talking about the current situation in Afghanistan with former Ambassador James Dobbins. He's former Special Envoy to Afghanistan, Colonel Douglas McGregor, U.S. Army, retired. David Wood is National Security Correspondent for PoliticsDaily.com, joining us from the NPR studios in New York City is Gail Lamont, Deputy Director of the Women and Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. She served as a journalist for nearly 10 years, covering presidential politics as a producer for ABC News. Most recently, she reported on events in Afghanistan for the Daily Beast. David Wood, you've just returned, as we said, from Afghanistan. You were embedded with the military. How are U.S. soldiers feeling about what's happening there?
They think they're doing well, and they like what they're doing. Well, you know, that's not quite true. I think a lot of people enlist in the army to go kill bad guys in revenge for 9/11. I hear that over and over and over again, a very strong common theme. When they get to Afghanistan, the fight is not killing bad guys. It's helping local folks, mentoring local police, patrolling with the army, in many cases working with the district governments that I was talking about. And so there's a certain amount of frustration. But they like doing that. They can see results, and they think this is a positive thing to be doing. But if you ask them, would you rather be killing bad guys? Oh, yeah.
Colonel McGregor.
I have to take issue with that, because the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that I talk to who are coming back and have spent 12 or more months in the country really develop a visceral distaste for the population. They don't like the people who live in Afghanistan. They don't understand them. The cultural gap that separates us from them is profound. For them, the best way to think of this, and this is not too different, by the way, from Iraq, where people had similar, very, very negative views of Arabs. It's kind of a trip up Joseph Conrad's river in the heart of darkness, where you are leaving the modern world and you're walking backwards in time into a very different society, and expecting the average American soldier, sailor, airman, or marine to understand that or even like it, I think is unrealistic. And this is the whole issue of why do you want to commit 100,000 U.S. conventional forces to a place like that? Why would you do that? How could that possibly help?
Ambassador Dobbins, here's an email from Daryl, who says, aren't we ignoring the reality of the situation? My forecast, along with many others, is that if and when the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan, the Taliban, who is biding their time in the shadows, will simply move in with their weapons and take over town after town. The local military and local leaders will be helpless, and we will have spent billions for absolutely nothing. How do we fix this, or can we?
Well, the Taliban aren't lurking in the shadows, biding their time. They're conducting a major offensive in the country, which is one of the reasons why casualty rates and levels of violence are up. On the other hand, all of the evidence suggests that the Taliban represent a very small proportion of the population. I think polling suggests they have support for perhaps 7% of the population. The Taliban are largely a Pashtun phenomenon. Pashtuns are about half of the population. The other half of the population, Tajiks, Uzbeks, not only don't support the Taliban, but believe that they have an equal right to share in the government of the country, and have always violently opposed the Taliban throughout the 90s. The civil war never ended, and would certainly oppose the Taliban, even if the Taliban were able to secure the control of most of the Pashtun areas of the country. So an American withdrawal would not lead to a return of the Taliban to Kabul and other cities. It would lead to an expanded civil war, large numbers of refugees. 7 million people left the country in the 90s, and you could see refugee flows on that order again. It's not clear who would win that civil war, but it would be a violent, bloody civil war, which would make the current fighting look very modest by comparison.
Colonel McGregor.
Well, there are 43 million Pashtun tribesmen, somewhere between 9 and 11 million in Afghanistan. They have to be seen as one people. Different factions of the Pashtun are fighting for different reasons, but collectively they have walked away from Kabul and from Islamabad for different kinds of reasons. So we've involved ourselves in a fight, again, that has nothing to do with us. Allegedly, we were fighting the Taliban because they're connected to al-Qaeda, but we've had everyone from General Jones to McChrystal make it very clear that simply isn't the case. And we've been urged to come to some sort of arrangement with the Taliban, which we reject for various reasons. It's true, the Uzbeks and Tajiks are very different. They're tied to their friends that used to live inside the Soviet Union. And then, of course, Herat in the southwest of the country is largely Iranian and under Iranian control. So this is not a nation state by any stretch of the imagination.
But how do you react to Ambassador Dobbins' point that if the U.S. were to withdraw somewhat precipitously, it would lead to civil war throughout the country?
Well, I don't think throughout is the right word. I think Ambassador Dobbins is right to first of all, caution people against the assumption that if we left, that the Taliban would take over. Even after the Soviets left, it took years before they were able to establish control over the country and impose order. I don't necessarily think they would. I think we have to understand that the current Taliban that's fighting us is supported by Pakistan as a strategic hedge against Indian influence in Kabul. All of this has to be seen against the backdrop of the Indo-Pakistani conflict. Again, this is not something that we should be part of, but we are.
How do you see it, David Wood?
Diane, I'm sorry. I didn't meet anybody who thought again, out on the ground where real stuff is happening. I didn't hear anybody arguing about whether they were under Pakistani or Iranian influence. I think this is a lot more of a local conflict than we sometimes think. And we like to gin up these grand theories to explain, how things are working in Afghanistan. But I just want to tell you about two interesting people I met there very quick. One was a district governor in a place called Gormak in far northwest Afghanistan, where the road literally ends. He is cobbling together, with the help of the local police chief and some village heads, the beginning of this kind of local government that I was talking about, grassroots, a very, very slow and painful process. But he said to me, I hope you stay with us this time because we need your help for a little bit longer. The other guy I want to tell you about is a village elder I met in a little place south of Kandahar. I went with an American cavalry captain there to sort of suss out the village and see what was happening. We ran across this guy, sat down on the ground, had a long conversation in the very hot sun. Are there any Taliban here? No, he said. Do you ever see Taliban? No, never see them. Eventually, the captain said, do you send your girls to school? And the guy just exploded. He said, we're like a soccer ball being kicked back and forth between the two sides. You want us to send our girls to school? The Taliban say if you send your girls to school, we'll kill them. What are we supposed to do? And he was just almost blind with rage and frustration at being caught between these two sides.
Now, turning back to you, Gail Amon, how effective do you believe these grassroots developments can really be in light of what David has just said, that the locals feel they're caught between a rock and a hard place?
Oh, I think that's right. I think locals feel that way because they are not sure how long the international community will remain with them. And I think that remains a question. And I was there for most of July doing interviews and talking to people who said what they were surprised about was that there was a real belief among the American public that Afghanistan left on its own could remain an isolated problem. People asked, do you not learn from history? And those are the questions that you, I think, get asked as a reporter very regularly on the ground in Afghanistan. And I think the extent of the success of the development programs in Afghanistan depend on the acceptance by the community and how well they were planned in the first place. I think the community development councils, which I'm sure a number of your folks who've been on this show have talked about before, have been pretty effective in terms of having local communities decide local priorities for themselves. And there are male and female community development councils. I think midwifery programs actually are one of the most successful development programs because they operate even in places where the international community cannot get to, because they're based on community acceptance. And Diane, I was wondering if I might just go back to the quick question about the exploitation on the cover of Time.
Of course.
And whether that's exploitation. I mean, I think both sides of this war debate are now fully exploiting this story for their own ends. And I think it's unfortunate because the truth is that this is a young woman who was brutalized and who is getting help because of the international community's presence. Now, you can argue whether we should have been there in the first place, but the fact is we're there. And it is space that has been created by the U.S. military, by the international community, that is allowing girls like her to get into a system of shelters that allows her to get to the United States for surgery to rebuild her face. When she was first attacked, her father took her to a forward operating base in Uruzgan, and it was the U.S. military who cleaned her wounds for the very first time because her own father saw that as a safe haven that otherwise would not have been possible in Uruzgan. So, I mean, you want to talk about community acceptance, even in very tough places, which I know Colonel McGregor and Ambassador Dobbins and Mr. Wood have all been in the region, right? I mean, Uruzgan is not an easy place for the international community to operate, and yet that's the first place that this young woman's father took her when he found his daughter injured.
Ambassador Dobbins, Colonel McGregor talked about dialogue, communication between the U.S. and the Taliban. Here's an email from Moises, who says the U.S. best path forward in the Afghan war is more communication, diplomacy with the Taliban. As Abraham Lincoln used to say, I destroy my enemies when I make them my friends. Is there a real possibility for diplomacy with the Taliban?
Well, I agree with the message, and I think there is a real possibility. I think one has to be cautious about how quickly that can be realized. President Karzai has declared his desire to negotiate a peaceful settlement with the Taliban leadership. The U.S. at the same time is trying to co-opt lower-level Taliban commanders and bring them over with their fighters, and is prepared to offer significant inducements in that regard.
Such as?
Such as guarantees of security, jobs,
money.
Well, I don't know that they're paying them. They're prepared to offer them guarantees of support and employment, as well as security. They might well put some of them on the payroll, as they did in Iraq. And these are not these are two sides of the same coin. It's a top-down approach and a bottom-up approach. The U.S. is not opposed to Karzai's efforts. They've expressed support for Karzai's efforts. So has the international community as a whole. I do think that their negotiations of this sort, once they start, tend to take a long time. Therefore, one shouldn't expect this to be an easy exit, but it is something we ought to be pursuing.
Ambassador James Dobbins, he's former special envoy to Afghanistan. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Colonel McGregor, tell me about the December evaluation that is to take place and what kinds of issues will be brought into that discussion.
Well, I think we're going to talk about the state of the Afghan forces, the army, the police, its readiness to assume responsibility. And of course, everyone who's looked at that has pointed out that Afghanistan is incapable economically of supporting the size and content of these large military and paramilitary forces, but we'll look at those. I'm sure there'll be discussions of institution building, all sorts of milestones and measures. Whether or not any of these mean anything truthfully to the ultimate outcome is open to debate. I don't think those are going to be decisive for what we do or don't do, frankly.
You don't. You simply believe it's going to be an exercise in worthlessness?
Well, worthlessness, I think it's a charade. I think people have decided that we're going to stay and we're going to continue to stay and spend money. We're on a course that, in my judgment, is not something the American people support or want, but we're on it, and I suspect we'll stay there until we can't afford to stay any longer.
Gail Lamont, what about that December evaluation? How do you see it?
I think I would actually agree with Colonel McGregor. I think that this administration has had a very difficult time communicating what exactly the objectives are and what the end game is in Afghanistan, and that you see a lot of issues crop up around this lack of a clear message. And I think that has made the December timeline and the July upcoming withdrawal date, or the beginning of withdrawal date or not, an enormous question mark sort of hanging over the entire effort. And you do, when you talk to military folks on the ground and when you talk to Afghans, everybody has questions about what this actually means.
All right. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Orleans, Massachusetts. Good morning, Dana.
Hello, hello. Well, hello, Diane. Welcome back, and your guests as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm no fan of the Taliban, certainly. I hate religious fanatics of all kinds, but I detest fanaticism, let's put it that way. But the United States is trying to justify U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Well, Time magazine is trying to justify the occupation of Afghanistan by putting a disfigured woman on its front cover. But I heard on a alternative radio program recently, which you can get online if you want to hear this woman speak, the United States didn't go in there to, quote, liberate women. The United States, a lot of the allies of Karzai in the United States, are just as exploitive and repressive towards women as the Taliban is.
Do you believe that? I wonder, Gail Lamont.
No, I don't. I do understand the point. I do understand the point that there are, in the Afghan parliament, men who actually believe fairly similarly to the Taliban. But what I think also happens is that you have female parliamentarians and you have a female advocates in civil society who are fighting back on their own behalf, again, using the space created by the international community to speak up for themselves, which is, I think, what everybody on this panel would agree is what has to happen for real change to occur. And you do see that happening. So I know this is an argument you hear a lot from folks who call the magazine war porn, but I actually don't think that's correct because women are speaking up on their own behalf.
Gail Lamond, she's deputy director of the Women and Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her upcoming book is titled The Dressmaker of Kara Kahana, due out in March 2011. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The oldest daughter of legendary singer Johnny Cash talks about growing up in the shadow of her famous father and how she emerged as a successful singer-songwriter. Roseanne Cash on Finding Her Own Voice, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we'll go right back to the phones as we talk about the current situation in Afghanistan, waning support in this country, as one of our guests said, simply and clearly, because we're not winning. Let's go to Edwardsville, Illinois. Good morning, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. As the dad of an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran, I want to thank you, Colonel McGregor. General Petraeus said in Congress here recently when he was in town, he said that trying to train and equip host nation forces in the middle of an insurgency is akin to building an advanced aircraft while it is in flight and while it is being designed and while it is being shot at. So what that says to me is we're trying to do some kind of bizarre and impossible experiment in Afghanistan, and the only result that I'm seeing out of it is the death and dismemberment of our own troops and Afghan civilians. There's much more I could say.
All right, Ambassador Davins.
Well, I think the whole nation-building concept has certainly become very controversial, in part because of some rather spectacular failures. But in fact, there's at least a dozen countries around the world that are living at peace today because either American or NATO or European or UN troops came in, separated the combatants, disarmed the contending factions, held elections, helped rebuild the economy. And so in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Mozambique, El Salvador, Namibia, Cambodia, Macedonia, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and a number of others, people are at peace today. They're not killing each other, and that's because the nation-building paradigm worked.
David Wood.
And also because of the good work of Ambassador Dobbins, I should say. I just want to say a word about the Afghan security forces. I spent a lot of time involved or watching training of both Afghan army and police. I also did a lot of foot patrols with the Afghan police in various parts of the country, so I've seen them operate close up, and I talked to a lot of them at length about their own backgrounds. These guys are pretty good. Hmm. You know, they don't need a lot from us. They need some direction, and they need some coordination. But they're pretty good, and, you know, I take Dave's point that this is a difficult job to do, to bring the Afghan security forces up to a point where they could take over from us. But I think we should not sell them short.
Here's an email for you, Gail Lamont. Russ says, our Secretary of State has said, we will never desert the women and girls of Afghanistan. I think it would be shameful and dangerous if we did. Is our word worth nothing? Can we be defeated by a few thousand extremists? That would not be a good message. Gail.
I think that is exactly the question that a lot of women and men ask reporters when they meet them and when they have these discussions. I think on the topic of reconciliation, because that seems to be, you know, a lot of the discussion around Kabul conference, surrounding the Kabul conference, was about this discussion of, can you have conversations with the Taliban? Is this the end game in terms of leading to a more peaceful Afghanistan and a stable country? And I think women want peace desperately, but what they fear is that their country's problems will be balanced on their backs once more. And I think that is what Secretary Clinton was trying to address very directly, both to President Karzai and to almost everybody who attended the Kabul conference. That morning, she actually met with a group of women leaders from around the country, including Herat and Kandahar, in part to send a message, I think, that this was something that was on the United States agenda. Mm-hmm. And it was very much appreciated by women leaders who, again, you know, when you talk about security forces, I mean, they do not ask the international community to stay forever. What they're really looking for is the space for their own army and police to be able to defend their constitutional rights to equal protection. And I actually just interviewed the first group of Afghan National Army officer candidates, female officer candidates. And, you know, it's a 6-month program, and these young women were really incredible incredibly eloquent about their desire to serve their country and to keep their country stable and to defend their nation.
All right, to Williamsburg, Virginia. Good morning, Lou. Lou, you're on the air. I guess not. Let's go now to Galesburg, Michigan. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen to you every morning.
Thank you.
A few years ago, Tony Blair suggested that the Western nations buy the opium crop, and it seems to me that would put money in the hands of farmers, take it out of the hands of warlords, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And also, couldn't we just arm the populace of Afghanistan? And I'll take your response off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. David Wood.
I did run into a number of militia who are, I mean, they're like home guards. They're people who live in the villages. When the Taliban come, they stand up to them. They're again, they come out of this cultural background of fighting. They're fighters. And even if they're not organized, you know, they do a pretty good job of defending their home village. I think with a little bit of recognition, more than anything else, maybe some money for ammunition, they could be a big part of the solution.
Colonel McGregor.
Well, I think it's important to understand in these Islamic societies, Iraq had similar problems and still does and will continue to into the future. And that is that there is a, it's very difficult to distinguish where the criminality ends or begins and where so-called ideologically committed insurgents start or finish. It's not clear. It's ambiguous. And again, what happened in Iraq is so radically different from the situation on the ground in Afghanistan.
How so?
Well, I think, first of all, the supposition that we won anything in Iraq is false. And I think we're going to watch things develop in Iraq that are ultimately antithetical to our strategic interests as a result.
As the U.S. draws down troops.
We suspended a war between ourselves and the Sunni Arab population, which we had fought unnecessarily for years. I would argue that we are currently fighting people in Afghanistan unnecessarily, people who are not, have no vested interest in fighting the United States or the American people. And this is back to the issue of why are we there to begin with? And the real reason was we wanted to prevent al-Qaeda from returning to Afghanistan. Well, the good news is that's very unlikely because the people there don't want them, but we've chosen in the meantime to wage war on this Taliban organization. The question is, how do you turn that around and how do you fix that problem? Because it's insoluble at this point.
Ambassador Dobbins.
Well, first of all, the Taliban is still closely linked with al-Qaeda, and there's absolutely nobody who suggests otherwise based on intelligence. They are linked in Pakistan, where the Taliban is based and where al-Qaeda is mostly located. There are Arab al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan, but the number is small. Taliban and al-Qaeda are closely linked, and they're closely linked in the sanctuaries they operate out of in Pakistan.
By the way, I disagree with that assertion. I think that you have different kinds of Taliban with different agendas. This is very fragmented, very diverse, very complex. But the notion that what's happening in Afghanistan is in any way, shape, or form animated, motivated, directed by al-Qaeda is false.
I don't think that's the question. The question is whether al-Qaeda can find a home in which it can operate freely. It's not incentivizing the Taliban, but it is a parasite that lives off the Taliban and can gain space to conduct its worldwide activities if the Taliban were to gain greater control of territory.
Ambassador Dobbins, as I hear you speak, I gather what you're saying is if we add more and more troops to Afghanistan as we did in Iraq, that somehow this country is going to settle down to establish itself peacefully, to create these local organizations with the help of the U.S. Is that what you believe?
I'm not advocating increasing our troop strength there. As I said, I think the administration is on a glide path to gradually reduce them beginning next year. And I think that's a reasonable objective and one they have some prospect of attaining. I do believe, however, that we have important interests associated with stabilizing Afghanistan and leaving it a society at peace with itself and its neighbors.
And that's the question. Do you believe that we can leave it as a peaceful nation?
Yes, but I don't believe that we can do it overnight.
And you believe it's going to take until at least 2014?
Well, the objective is not to leave it at peace in 2014, but leave it capable of maintaining its own security. Ideally, a negotiated settlement would result in peace, and I believe that's worth pursuing, although, as I've suggested, I think one has to be cautious about how quickly that could proceed.
How does one go about beginning a negotiation with the Taliban and the Afghan government?
I think at this stage it requires and has largely received U.S. backing for Karzai's efforts in this regard. But I think the United States also needs to talk to the countries that have influence with the Taliban and with other factions in Afghanistan.
So we
need to recreate the kind of international coalition we had back after 2001, which consisted of Pakistan, India, Iran, Russia, the countries that have backed the different factions in Afghanistan over the years and get them to put pressure on their clients within Afghanistan, a convergent pressure, pushing them together rather than the more normal situation in which the outside actors are pulling them apart.
A successful path, Colonel McGregor?
Well, Ambassador Dobbins has hit on something that's very important. It is Iran and Russia and India who have the strategic interests in this place, not us. They are the ones who have the most at stake. We have deformed the natural forces in the region by essentially moving in, expending huge resources, and committing large numbers of troops to something that, frankly, is not our mission. Iran has interests, as I said, in the southwest, and they are the dominant force there. The Uzbeks and Tajiks are tied to the Russians and to their friends on the other side of the border. Afghanistan is not a nation state. It's a region with different peoples in it. This region has enjoyed, for periods of time, some measure of tranquility. Can it do that again? And I think the answer is probably yes. But given the circumstances right now, I don't think that 100,000-plus U.S. troops, 100,000 contractors, are going to contribute to that outcome.
All right. To Joanne, who's in Jackson, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And I've missed you, and I'm really pissed. And I'm sorry if I'm not articulate about this, but if we are supportive of women, I've always considered NPR news-type programs as the most reliable sources of information in the USA. And I have heard women in Iraq speaking about how the USA has set them back well over 1,000 years, but it sounds more like 5,000 years to me, that women have been speaking, Iraq women have been speaking about how even in Baghdad they are being arrested for not wearing burqas, for not covering their entire bodies with clothing. They're being thrown in jail. How they used to be able to attend school under Saddam. How Saddam kept Iran and terrorists from screwing up Iraq. Now, if we are bailing on those women in Iraq, what are we going to do for the women in Afghanistan?
Joanne, thanks for your call. In the future, I would appreciate your not using language as you did at the start of your commentary. Gail Lamont, what's your reaction?
I think that these situations in Iraq and Afghanistan are very different. I have heard similar stories about women in Iraq facing many more difficulties, many more limits on their mobility, restrictions on work, restrictions on attire, post-American invasion than during Saddam. And I think that is absolutely stories that you hear. I think in Afghanistan, you have actually the flip side of that, which is that it was the U.S.-backed government, the President Karzai's administration, who, while hardly champions of women, have been the administration under which women have regained their rights to go to school and go to work. And the fear is that if there is reconciliation without protection of their rights, they will go right back into this utopian vision that the Taliban had of, you know, the period of Islam's founding, which was really not a system that any of these women had lived under before outside of particular regions in the Pashtun belt. Yeah. And women had never had those kinds of restrictions on education and work that they had to live under the Taliban. And that's what they fear, is
and
that it comes back.
You are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One last caller in Utica, New York. Good morning, Roger.
Yes, good morning, Diane and panel. Afghanistan is just a quagmire. It was poorly conceived and poorly pulled off right from the onset. The bottom line is we need to get out of there. If we leave in 5 months, 5 years, 15 years, it's going to turn to chaos.
Ambassador Dobbins.
Well, I certainly agree that that in the immediate aftermath of the overthrow of the Taliban, we had opportunities to stabilize the country and begin its reconstruction, which we failed to take advantage of. I think the focus on Iraq, the administration's, the Bush administration's adverse view of the whole concept of nation building meant that we lost several years. Now, this wasn't several years of war. There was no war in Afghanistan in 2002, 2003, and there were very few American troops. We're making up lost ground at the moment, and it's tough and it's costly, but I do think that it can be done.
Colonel McGregor.
Well, I'm someone who agrees with your previous caller. I don't think that there is a benefit to us strategically. I think we would benefit from leaving. And I think right now we're a cause celeb, once again, for attracting and mobilizing Muslims against us. And I would be much more concerned about Muslim terrorism in London, England, and in various American cities and in other places in Europe than anything that happens in Afghanistan.
But surely you're not advocating a massive pullout beginning now.
Well, I think we should get out, and I think we should start as soon as possible. The Karzai government is a narco state. It's hopelessly corrupt. We're losing millions of dollars on a daily basis to them. This just needs to end. I think it has been poorly conceived, and I don't see it changing.
Colonel Douglas McGregor, U.S. Army, retired. He's the author of Warrior's Rage, the Great Tank Battle of 73 Easting. Ambassador James Dobbins, he's former special envoy to Afghanistan, currently at the RAND Corporation. David Wood, national security correspondent for PoliticsDaily.com. And Gail Lamont, she's deputy director of the Women and Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening, all. Have a great day.